Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Like its urban counterparts all over the country, St. Louis is dealing with the ongoing problem of urban crime. For law enforcement, it is, of course, a constant challenge. So how is St. Louis doing just after the halfway point of this year? I'm Don Marsh. With us to talk about the challenges and how they are being met are Chief Sam Dotson of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department and Professor Rick Rosenfeld, University of Missouri St. Louis criminologist. He works closely with the St. Louis PD as an analyst and consultant. Gentlemen, nice to see you again.
Don, how are you?
Good. Chief, you getting settled into your new digs?
Well, actually, we've started the moving process. I'm slated to move next Thursday, I think, and then in about 3 weeks, the building will be fully operational.
Isn't moving wonderful? Don't you just love it?
Well, imagine moving your family times about 1,000 employees. So we've got 1,000 people that will be moving over the next 3 weeks.
Well, you know, most of us when we move find we have a lot more stuff than we needed. Are you finding that?
Our shredders have been working overtime to make sure that our new home isn't overrun.
Well, good luck in the new home. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the sense in reading the newspapers and watching television and listening to the radio that there has been kind of an uptick in violent crime in the city in recent weeks and months. Am I right or wrong on that, Chief?
I think it's perception and the way that the media covers it. Every chief worries about violent crime, homicides, aggravated assaults, and overall crime in the city is down over 11% through the first 6 months. Violence is down almost 6% over the first 6 months. So we do have our challenges. I won't be Pollyannish about it. When anybody uses a gun to inflict harm on another one, it's newsworthy and it gets attention in St. Louis. But I think it's important to have context. Crime in the city of St. Louis since 2006 is down almost 50%. Those are tremendous gains. So you have to look at it in historical perspective. We have many fewer crimes now than we did just 5 years ago.
Rick, you're the stats guy. The numbers must look pretty good to you.
They do. Every year, in fact, I can remember speaking with you in past years, Don. During the summer, the early part of the summer, there's concern about a, quote, uptick in crime. Well, crimes do go up, especially street crimes, more people on the street when the weather is better. And when these crimes cluster together, it does appear, I think, and the media certainly covers this and reinforces what may be a misperception, that across the board crime is going up. But as the chief says, the crime is down during the first part of this year, first half. I have data through July 23rd, and crime is down in, you know, all the major categories, with the single exception, and needless to say, and a very important one, of homicides. Through July 23rd, 66 homicides were recorded in the city, and that compares to 57 in the previous year. So there's work to be done there. But in the other categories, crime is down across the board.
Chief, if there's work to be done in the area of homicides, how do you deal with that? What kind of work are we talking about?
Let's talk about homicides first as a category. Probably the single most difficult category for us to intervene on. Last year, 120 murders in the city of St. Louis. This year, as Rick said, we've seen an increase of about 12. Some of the murders that we've seen this year, no police intervention that I'm aware of would have made a difference. Parents that are responsible for the care of their children in two cases contributed to the death of their children, which were counted as homicides. In two cases, adult children murdered their parents in their home, one on Easter Sunday. Again, no police intervention. So one of the toughest categories. What we do look at are aggravated assaults, and specifically aggravated assaults with guns, as a precursor to violent homicides. So as we talk about hotspot policing, as we talk about deploying resources throughout the city, that's the single key indicator, the biggest key indicator that I use about deploying resources. If we can interrupt the cycle of violence around aggravated assaults and aggravated assaults with guns, hopefully we can reduce the number of homicides that happen in the city.
And how is that going with regard to the hotspot policing and its effectiveness?
I think it's going very well. This is a department that has full throttle embraced the principle of hotspots policing. And why don't we, for the benefit of your listeners, just describe what that strategy entails. Mm-hmm. using real-time or near real-time crime information, the police department determines where crime is clustering and where it has increased very, very recently, often within the last few days. They deploy resources, you know, heavier patrols to those areas in the effort to reduce crime in those areas. And fortunately, there's little evidence that crime then will spread out. In other words, the idea that you push a balloon here, it'll burst out there, that's not what we see. So we don't see crime displaced to other areas when it's suppressed in a given area. That strategy is the single most effective strategy police departments around the world these days have developed to reduce both serious violent and property crime. I think it's working well in St. Louis. And I should say I'm very impressed with the openness on the part of the command staff, the chief and his captains and majors, to experimental work. That's how you find out what works and exactly why it works and how to tweak it to make it work better. And this department's very open to that kind of thing.
The last time we talked, you had just consolidated your district's chief. How is that working? Is there any evidence that that has been effective in any way in dealing with these problems?
I think that the redistricting that we undertook on January 27th is helping officers focus into those problem areas, the hotspot policing strategies. What we did was we saw that the districts in the city of St. Louis had been very identically drawn since 1962. So over the last 50 years, there had been no change. As population shift moved from one neighborhood to another, as crime patterns, the district patrol plan remained the same. In moving from 9 districts to 6 districts, it allowed us to deploy resources in a way that we think makes sense. Each district has essentially the same workload, same number of calls for service, similar amount of crime, same number of officers. That approach makes sense. Last year, crime was down about 5.5% or so. This year, so far year-to-date, we're down over 11%. I think redistricting had a contributing factor to that.
Okay. You know, it just brings to mind a question with regard to crime stats going down, Rick. We've talked about this before. Is crime down because the policing is better, or is crime down because of the economy? You had indicated in a previous conversation that when the economy is down, crime is down because there's nothing to steal, basically.
The economy is improving, and so perhaps that's good news for thieves. But it's a combination of both. I don't think anyone supposes that the police department has 100% control over the crime problem. I often use the analogy of the degree to which hospitals and doctors control sickness and disease. They respond to it. They can be very proactive, and they can contain it. And I think that's the proper way to think about the relationship between the police and crime. If the effective strategies in St. Louis were all that mattered, then we would expect crime in other cities that aren't using those strategies or using them as well to be going up, or at least not to be going down at the same rate. But we see crime down in St. Louis County. We see crime down in Kansas City. That is not to say that the policing efforts in St. Louis aren't contributing significantly to the decline, but there are lots of other factors involved.
Right. Give me some.
Well, you mentioned the economy. The economy is certainly an important factor. I've said, I think, on this program before, something that many of your listeners may not have thought about, but the inflation rate. We've been running at historically low inflation rates in the United States. So think about what that means for crime. People purchase stolen goods for one reason only, their low price. As prices go up in the legitimate markets, the demand for stolen goods increases because of their low price, and that's incentives for thieves and robbers to, you know, to meet that demand. But as prices stay low, and they have remained very, very low in the U.S., and including St. Louis over the last several years, that demand diminishes somewhat, and that contributes to flat or lower property crime rates, and I think to a degree violent crime rates as well. So that's one among a number of factors in addition to effective policing that affects crime rates.
Street economics. It's not the Fed, but it certainly is. It certainly reflects what's going on.
It's the same principles that operate in any market.
Right. Chief, I have an email question here, and I must confess I hadn't heard about this, but while we're talking about getting a grip on crime and going to places where it's heavier, the question is concerns real-time and real-time intelligence center. I've not been aware that that's something you've been thinking about. The question is, what's the need for it in St. Louis? Where does it fit in the strategy of policing, and how do you funding? So begin with, what is it?
Real-time intelligence center, or real-time crime center, is what the city of St. Louis is the next legitimate, logical step for law enforcement. Cities all over the country, Philadelphia, Chicago, Memphis, L.A., have really made this leap into it. It does a couple of things. One, it brings cameras in to the police department. Right now, the police department has access to some cameras, some surveillance cameras throughout the city. It really creates a framework or a network to bring those into law enforcement. It creates an opportunity for real-time information sharing. So the professor talked about the instantaneous information sharing that happens. If a crime occurs in one part of the city, we know that criminals are mobile and can move to another part. It's triaging those, providing information to the officers on the street about crime patterns, crime trends in real time so they can respond to it. As we move into our new headquarters building at 1915 Olive, we've left half of a floor of that building undeveloped for the future home of a real-time crime center. Funding, the city of St. Louis is currently looking at a bond issue sometime later this fall or early next spring. We've put money in that for a real-time intelligence center. Many aldermen have asked me to create programs for cameras, cameras in parks, cameras in neighborhoods. This is the backbone and the infrastructure for that. And looking at the way Chicago did it as a model, it's a real public-private partnership. Instead of the city making an investment into thousands and thousands of cameras, we leverage the cameras that are already there. Washington Avenue has cameras. The zoo may have cameras. The ballpark may have cameras. And we have ability to have access to those, to monitor them, to reduce crime, to help solve crimes.
If you don't get help on the bond front, how do you fund it?
We're actually in conversations right now with Motorola about making St. Louis a pilot program. And them, Motorola, donating equipment to the Metropolitan Police Department to start up and running a real-time intelligence center, real-time crime center.
Rick, whenever we start talking about cameras, and again, we've talked about cameras a lot in our community and others, the privacy issues arise. Do you have any concerns about that part of it?
I would if I saw evidence that cameras are being misused for surveillance purpose that has no legitimate law enforcement need attached to it. I haven't seen that evidence, certainly in St. Louis. There's always the potential for misuse. In fact, though, I would be concerned about something like the opposite. That is, cameras are put up, but if they're not regularly and very actively monitored, and that's not cheap. That's expensive. Someone has to sit and watch. And then if signs of a crime being committed are not immediately relayed to the police, it doesn't take long for people on the street, including people who are up to no good, to conclude these things, they're just shells.
Sure.
They don't work. So they have to be actively monitored. That's what the research says. And I think a real-time intelligence center will help in that regard.
Right. Dare I use the word drones when it comes to watching what's going on? We chuckle about that, but this is an issue that has come up with you and with other police officers. Where do we stand with the whole drone issue?
I think as technology advances, law enforcement all over the country are looking at ways to force multipliers. Drones, unmanned aerial observation platforms is the name we choose to use, will add to law enforcement, will help law enforcement do their job. Right now, we all sit in front of our TV screens or our computers and watch YouTube videos of drones with GoPro cameras that film over Mardi Gras, that film over Fair St. Louis.
Cats, generally. I think they're pretty plugged into cats.
And we watch with amazement of that. But think about the technology and the application of it in keeping our community safe. So that's really and I always am sensitive to the privacy issues. But as people move around on public streets and public spaces, there is no expectation that they're not being caught on video, whether it's at the movie theater, at a bank, or just walking down the street. People are caught on video several times a day.
Yeah. That's Chief Sam Dotson of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. He's in studio with us, along with Rick Rosenfeld, a professor of criminology at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. We'll continue this conversation, kind of an update on what's going on with the St. Louis PD in just a moment. If you would like to get into the discussion, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL On Air. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation, updating the situation with the St. Louis Police Department, with the Chief of Police, Sam Dotson, and also with Rick Rosenfeld from the University of Missouri-St. Louis. However, these are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. These before we continue our conversation. Legislation co-sponsored by Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill was announced today that aims to protect college students against sexual assaults and improve accountability for institutions. The Campus Safety and Accountability Act also establishes penalties for non-compliance with the legislation's standards for training, data, and best practices. The city of St. Louis is attempting to put every homeless veteran in the city in housing by the end of today. The city has 50 apartments ready for homeless veterans, the estimated number currently living in the city. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn plans to sign a bill this afternoon that his office says will help students in life-threatening situations. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan is also scheduled to attend that event today. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on 90.7 FM and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with the Chief of Police, Sam Dotson, and Rick Rosenfeld of UMSL. Chief, a couple of issues on the ballot next week that I know you're watching very closely, and in fact, one of them in which you've been involved. We're talking about the right to bear arms and the protection of electronic data. Let's start with electronic data. The Supreme Court ruled on that earlier this year. A lot of people think this is unnecessary. They also think that it will impact police work. Would it if it passes?
The protection of electronic data, you're talking about cell phones.
Exactly.
The way that we perform our investigations, it won't impact us because if there's something that we're interested in, we go to a court that has jurisdiction and get a search warrant or a subpoena. That's the right way to do it, to obtain the information. It's standard practice for us, so it doesn't change the way that we do business in the city at all.
All right. Now, the right to bear arms is a horse of a different color or whatever. I know you've been involved in challenging the wording of that, and you were unsuccessful before the courts. What are the police implications of this?
Well, you're talking about the Amendment 5, which will be on the ballot on August 5th. The concern is that it puts the right to bear arms into a new space. Right now, the Missouri Constitution, the United States Constitution, protects your right and my right to bear arms. 100% supportive of that. I understand it. The new language goes around, if you will, the conceal and carry process and will allow individuals to present a defense that they have an inalienable right to carry a gun. It will make criminal prosecutions more difficult. It will make convictions more difficult. And it will allow criminals to carry guns justifiably and legally. I'm not challenging your right or my right. What I'm saying is this law, the change in the language will create a situation where it's more difficult for police and prosecutors to get convictions and will ultimately make our community less safe.
Am I right in thinking that most police officers aren't really in favor of conceal and carry?
They're personal decisions. They are. Police officers are in a unique situation. We have our weapons, and I understand that. And that's why when I have the conversation with the public, not questioning your right, but why are you going to make a situation that changes something, a right that you already have, and loosens the restriction to make it okay for criminals to have the same right that you do? That's really what this conversation is about. You have the right now. It loosens it to make it okay for criminals.
Rick, the proponents of conceal and carry say that it helps reduce crime. You look at things like this. Does it?
No. to put it bluntly, I think the debate over that has diminished somewhat in recent years. But my reading of the evidence suggests that it has little effect one way or another. So I don't think it increases crime, but I don't think it reduces crime.
There are a lot of guns out there, regardless of who has them and how they're carried.
There are. And to this point of kind of the legal environment of, around guns and the degree to which that influences the behavior of and our ability to respond to the illegal use of guns or misuse of guns. Think of this situation. A police officer stops a car and there are several young men in the car. And there's a firearm sitting open in the car, but not on anyone's lap, not clearly in anyone's possession. Police officer runs the records and finds that several of the young men have pretty extensive records of felony arrests. Right? He asks, who owns this gun? And no one says a thing. No one claims ownership. In the state of Missouri, as of the last few years, one can carry a firearm in a motor vehicle without a permit. And insofar as the police officer can't establish ownership of that firearm, then the circuit attorney's office won't issue charges, felon in possession of a firearm, because there's no basis for determining who possessed the firearm. It's that statute that allows for the open carry of a firearm in a vehicle without a permit that bothers me, and I think is indicative of the kind of loosening of what I regard as entirely reasonable regulations that could very well over time make our gun violence problem even worse.
Chief, your take on that?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think the legislature has – I was in Jefferson City at the end of this session talking to a legislator, and he said it's an election year. I have to have a gun bill. So instead of doing what's right for communities' safety, like St. Louis, like Kansas City, the politicians, and who will go nameless, but the legislators in Jefferson City, create these straw men that they think they have to have a gun bill to be reelected, and it's moving us down a path that leaves our community less safe. Talked about the loophole for any individual in a car that's 23 years old that has a gun that we can't arrest them for. Legislation that would make it illegal for us to take a gun from you unless we're going to arrest you. But now imagine if you're a police officer that goes to a domestic disturbance. And so there's already a gun in plain view. The officer can't seize that gun unless I have the intention to arrest you. Puts our officers in risk. It puts our community at risk.
You know, speaking of guns, and we have spoken of this before, the notion that gun courts might be a good idea. That has really gotten nowhere, speaking of the legislature. Do we need gun courts, Rick?
I think we do. I don't know that we would call it a gun court, but I certainly was a strong proponent of the proposal to establish a specialized docket in the 22nd Circuit.
Just elaborate on it for sure. Our listeners exactly what the court
What this
would,
would have entailed is that two judges would have exclusive, if you will, jurisdiction over gun-related cases. Typically, those are unlawful use of a weapon, unlawful possession, or felon in possession of a weapon. What that would have produced, it seems to me, is what all specialized courts are supposed to do. They generate specialized knowledge on the part of judges who deal with those cases and those cases alone. So the gun docket, the judges decided – it was a relatively close vote, but they decided not to move forward with that. No one, however, disputed the need for better information about how the local criminal justice system, including the local circuit of the state felony courts, responds to gun violence. I've recently completed a report based on a sample of gun-related cases from 2011. I just circulated that report to the chief and the other criminal justice heads in the city, and once they have a chance to digest it, my intention is to make it public. And I think it does two things. First of all, it, for me, confirms the need for continuous monitoring of how the system itself responds to gun violence. One finding from the report, just under two-thirds of persons who are either convicted or plead guilty to unlawful use of a weapon, unlawful possession of the weapon, are placed on probation. I'm not suggesting that's either a good or bad decision in the aggregate, but what I am suggesting is no one knew what that statistic was because heretofore we've had these silos. The circuit attorney's office has their information system, police has theirs, corrections theirs, and so forth, and no way to merge so that we could get a sense of how the system itself is behaving. We're now getting a kind of glimmer of we're peering into that black box. And I'm hopeful that the public will find the results of that monitoring process quite useful. I think they will.
Yeah. We have a lot of calls. I want to bring up one other issue before we go to them, Chief, and that is the decriminalization, if you will, the ordinance in the city on the marijuana situation. How is that working out?
Well, it technically didn't decriminalize. What it did was is it lessened the punishment that is available for
decriminalize
that.
Decriminalize is one word is being used. Legalization is another. They're misused all the time. Sorry.
It's interesting. St. Louis is part of a group called the Major City Chiefs, Major City Police Chiefs. I sit around a table with the 40 largest police departments in the country, and they are all struggling with this. The consensus among the chiefs is that decriminalizing, legalizing, lessening the punishments for marijuana use will not take care of the black market issues that are associated with it, the underground activities, the criminal aspect of it. I think we're starting to see a little bit of that in Colorado now. I think after the initial flash of marijuana being legalized there, they are seeing that it hasn't addressed the criminal problem. Chiefs realize that many states are headed in that direction right now. It will continue to be a problem no matter what level it is because criminals will still continue to operate inside those margins.
Rick, what we hear from Colorado, have been hearing, though, is crime is down there since the implementation of this.
Right. I don't think legalization of marijuana for recreational use in Colorado has produced a crime boom, but I think the chief's absolutely right. It's certainly in the short run, there's no reason to suspect that the street distribution, street sale of marijuana is going to disappear. In fact, what Colorado is experiencing is something almost like the opposite. The street markets now have to compete with the legal markets on quality. Mm-hmm. They still beat them on price because the legal markets are taxed. But they have to compete on quality, and so they're upgrading the product on the street, and that's certainly not reducing demand for street. It's going to take a while, but I think ultimately we are going to see some diminution in at least the street distribution of marijuana, but that's going to be a long while off.
There does seem to be a trend and a movement toward decriminalization and ultimately legalization. I think only two states have legalized it at the present time. Good idea? Bad idea, Chief?
Major city chiefs, we sit around. We don't think it's a good idea. We think that it will continue. Again, price is going to be the variable there. The street market will continue to undersell or have lesser prices, so therefore it still will be more desirable.
We did a program on this a week or two ago, and one of the guests on the program said, and surprised me, that the city no longer has a narcotics unit. Is that an error?
By name, no, it's not. But we have divided those functions up into a group we call special operations. And there's an anti-crime unit in that, the narcotics unit, the interdiction unit. So by name, no, but by function, yes.
Okay, good. Let's go to the phones. And we'll start with Andrew, who's been waiting the longest. He's calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Chief Dotson, I read an article about 3 or 4 months ago in the Post-Dispatch. It was very interesting. It was about a program that I believe your department was doing to put younger officers walking beats in certain high-crime neighborhoods. I was wondering if you're still doing that program and why it's not, I guess, more widespread. It seems to me that if you have more of these so-called presence patrols where officers are actually walking through the neighborhoods, that that'd be a very effective deterrent to more crime. And I was wondering just if you're still doing that and why it's not more of a widespread program. Thank you.
I absolutely agree with you. We are continuing the program. The program that you read about was when recruits graduate from our police academy and are sent to their assignments. In their first 90 days, we require them to spend 30 days walking footbeats. That does a couple of things for me. It eases the recruit into police work. It increases their understanding and their value of community-oriented policing, their relationships in the community. I would like to continue the program with recruits on a larger scale. It's really an efficiency issue. We handle over 300,000 calls for service a year with the Metropolitan Police Department. Footbeats are great, and we encourage officers to do them as frequently as they can. But the economy really the economy of scale of work really requires us to move more quickly around, and officers on foot aren't capable of doing that. as quickly as they are in cars. But we do track the number of footbeats that are performed, and we encourage officers to do more of them every week.
We have another call here. Let's bring in Carrie calling from South St. Louis. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, Don. Long-time listener. This is my first time calling.
Great.
Wanted to call about the hot spots. I live in South City, where obviously I can see we're in a hot spot. I see cops every day, all day. And I'm a musician, and I play down on South Broadway a lot, and I've been really concerned with the rise in shootings that's been happening down there. And on the other side of that, I don't seem to see as many cops on South Broadway as I see in South City. I was just wondering if that's a misconception, or are we going to get more down there? I personally would feel safer to see as many cops on South Broadway as I see in South City. Thank you.
And I appreciate the call and the comment. South Broadway, unfortunately, a month and a half ago or so, there was a shooting. A gentleman having a dispute with his girlfriend fired shots indiscriminately. One struck a musician from the Broadway Oyster Bar. We've made an arrest in that case, and we've cleared it. The 4th District, where you're talking about downtown, has slightly more officers than other parts of the city because they are funded by a grant that we receive from the Downtown Partnership. I'd like to think that it's a misperception, or that you don't see officers down there, because they are, and the 4th District is doing a great job, especially on event days. It's got trade, baseball, events at the Dome. I'll make sure that I pass your comment along to the district captain.
Thanks for the call. Let's bring in Brandt calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Brandt.
Hi. I live across the street from a city park, and we had problems a couple of years ago, and started calling the police. I mean, if I see one person after 10 o'clock, I call, unless they're running in the park or something. And things have really shaped up in my neighborhood. I don't see anybody there after 10. And I just want to commend the police force that you've really done your job well, and in that regard. And I also wanted to say that we had a fellow that broke into some garages in a neighborhood west of me. It was like over about a good year and a half of break-ins, and they finally got him, and I forgot how many charges he had on him. And some of the neighbors from the neighborhood went to his sentencing, and the maximum penalty was to be 15 years. He got every bit of it. And I just want to tell the listening public that if you show up for the sentencing dates, it does kind of push the judges toward stiffer sentencing.
Brandt, thank you so much for the call. Rick, you're nodding your head. That's a key point. Huh?
I don't have systematic evidence on that, but I think the anecdotal evidence is persuasive that when people show up, especially we talked earlier about to bond reduction hearings, and if the sentiment of the group is that the bond should not be reduced, or at least dramatically reduced, bonds don't tend to go down quite as much.
Right. You'll take as many of those calls, Chief, as you can get, won't you?
Absolutely. And I think the key message was there with the community's involvement. He called 911. He told us about a problem. We were able to address it. The going to the court for the sentencing, absolutely. Let me tell you, and it's not an anecdote, it actually happened, about what happens, the difference between when the community is involved and when it's not involved. We talked about bond reduction hearings. Last week, we talked about a young man that we arrested with a gun. One judge gave him a $30,000 cash-only bond. 3 days later, another judge at a bond reduction hearing changed it to $10,000, 10% cash, so for $1,000. Guess what happened to that young man? 2 weeks later, we arrested him again. So it's important that the community shows up. When we talk about making our city safer, the police department arrests between 27 and 30,000 people a year. Many of them are frequent flyers, repeat customers. When we do make progress, we have to get outcomes that keep the city safe. Revolving doors don't do that.
And that's Chief Sam Dotson of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. He's with us in studio, as is Rick Rosenfeld, professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We have to take another break. We'll do that and come back, continue our conversation. And if you'd like to get in on it, we have some lines open at 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with the Chief of the St. Louis Police Department, Sam Dotson, and criminologist, professor, criminology professor, Rick Rosenfeld, from University of Missouri, St. Louis. The parks were mentioned a moment ago. It brings to mind a recent event in the city of St. Louis that you were paying special attention to, Fair St. Louis in the Park. Seemed to go pretty well. But what did you learn this time? We're going to do it again next year, I gather.
Well, the fair hasn't made an announcement yet of what their location will be for the 2015 fair. We learned that Forest Park is a wonderful venue for the event. I couldn't think of a better concert stage on Art Hill for the shows that happened. Traffic, we cleared almost as quickly as we would a Muni night in the park, and one arrest over the 3 days for a young man that thought it was okay to bring his own fireworks show to the park. I don't think we could have had a better event in the park.
It was incredible. It really was that there was so little activity that caused police concern in that. You sir, Rick, you're nodding.
I was on Art Hill on the 4th, and I had a lovely time.
Right. Well, we'll see if it happens again next year. I was under the impression that it probably would, given the pace of construction downtown. Another question that I have from the an emailer is, it concerns cross-deputization with county police officers. That's been discussed in the past. Is that going to happen?
Actually, I believe it will. In the relatively short future, we know crime is a regional problem. We know that criminals that offend in the city offend in the county and vice versa. It only makes sense that we have a regional approach to that. Tim Fitch and now Chief John Belmer in St. Louis County couldn't have better partners. We already have many joint ventures, bombing and arson. We fly a helicopter together. We ride Metrolink together. Cross-deputization seems like the next logical step.
And getting back to the idea of civilian involvement or citizen involvement, I should say, what about civilian review of the police department? Where does that stand?
Right now, there are several versions of bills that are being discussed in the Board of Aldermen. But I would also offer that we do a great job of policing ourselves. There are probably, since I've been chief, close to 24 individuals, employees of the police department that are no longer employed because we didn't like their conduct. We take every complaint that comes in the door. We look at racial profiling numbers. We are very proactive. So I think there is a level of oversight. In the last couple of months, I've spent several hours in the Board of Aldermen talking about the police department, talking about the things we have done. And then the public safety director, Rich Gray, held a forum just a week and a half ago to talk about what's going on in all of public safety in the city.
But there is always an element of concern when people are investigating themselves.
And I would point to, let's just talk about the police officer-involved shooting of Carrie Ball. The family was concerned about the police department conducting an investigation. I read the investigation. I was happy that I was happy with the quality of the investigation, but I knew there would always be a question. I passed that investigation to the FBI and ultimately the U.S. Attorney, and they came back and validated the investigation of the Metropolitan Police Department. I think that's where you get transparency, where you get other agencies looking at it. I have no problem in doing that in the future if there are questions. If there are questions that families will have about the conduct of police officers, I have no problem at all passing that along if I'm not happy with the investigation.
Rick, your thoughts on that, the idea of officers investigating themselves?
I do think this police department does a good job in its internal investigations. I'm not opposed on principle to civilian review. What I would point out, though, is that there's a, if you will, a ground game of civilian review that happens week in, week out at local meetings run by captains of every police district. Every resident of the district can show up to those meetings, can yell like hell if they want about problems in the district. And if they show up continuously, things change. So while we may debate the merits of civilian review kind of writ large, it happens all the time. Now, in those community meetings, officers aren't, there's no adjudication process for officers who may have been accused of misbehavior. But in every other aspect of policing, the community makes a huge difference. So people who are interested in civilian review, I would strongly encourage them to get into that ground game and attend those meetings.
Well, officers in New York City are getting a lot of civilian review right now as a result of that unfortunate death of Eric Garner, I believe his name was. That's been well publicized. You know, it's a terrible way to ask the question, but you have to wonder if something like that could happen here. Do we have anything that could prevent an incident like that from happening involving police officers taking somebody down?
I think that training is the best tool that there is. We have what we call a force continuum. And the key is to use the least amount of force to overcome the resistance. We provide officers with mace, with tasers, with a variety of tools. And anything is always possible. It's a human enterprise. Police officers do a great job day in and day out. And there are 35,000 police officers in New York, and you're aware of one incident in recent time that happens. And so I agree. We always have to focus on making sure that that doesn't happen. Possibility always exists. We overcome it by training and giving the officers the proper tools they need to do their jobs.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll bring in Jay calling from Riverview. Go ahead, Jay.
Yes, hi, Chief. I heard your comments about the amendment. I think it's a very bad amendment regarding the gun situation. I'm even more concerned about what the Senate was trying to pass, which was a bill that had about school safety, but it also had open carry in that. I think that's a very provocative action, and I'm amazed that the legislature here thinks they need to pass it. What do you believe the status of open carry is right now? And by the way, as I understand it, this would take away any munis or counties' ability to regulate it and say it's not going to happen, let's say, in Maplewood or Kirkwood or wherever. Thank you.
I think any police chief, save Detroit, is going to say that more guns in their community is never the answer. And, you know, my statistics are a little bit old, but 300 million guns in the United States, that's 88 guns for every 100 people. Those guns last year killed over 11,000 people. That's why the CDC calls gun violence in the United States an epidemic. Of the homicides that we have in the city of St. Louis, 80-plus percentage are committed with firearms and illegal guns at that. We have to do something about that if we're committed to making our community safer. Open carry, I believe, does not make our community any safer.
You know, I remember a Time magazine article during the height of the Cold War in which it was pointed out there were more guns in this country that were in possession of either the U.S. or Soviet military at that time. I don't imagine the number has gone down at all during that period of time. Back to the phones. David in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I am now about a four-year resident of St. Louis in the Tower Grove Heights area, and I just want to say that in our 4 years of living here, it's been a terrific experience, and I think your force does a great job. My question relates to there's been a recent restructuring of the way Utah and Grand interact, and because of that, it seems like there's been an increase in speeding across Utah heading west and a increase in people kind of blowing that new stop sign. And then just in that Tower Grove area in general, both east and the Heights and around that area of the park, there's a lot of flying of stop signs. So as a citizen, what do we do? With the amount of kids that live in that area, how do we engage that better, either through you guys or through the community?
I think you took the first step right now. You let the chief of police know, and I will make sure that that's on our list of things to do to pay attention to. And I think if the design is wrong, and I'm vaguely familiar with the changes that happened there, if the design is wrong, then we need to sit down with the engineers in the city and say, okay, let's create a way that reduces speeding so we don't have to do enforcement.
You know, the whole issue of red light cameras is before the Missouri Supreme Court right now. I think the court has two cases. Your thoughts on that? Red light cameras, good idea, bad idea?
I think it comes back to, and a lot of people lose the sight of this or lose the focus of it, either you violated the light or you didn't violate the light. And so we as a society have crafted these traffic laws to try and keep ourselves safe. So whether it's enforcement from a police officer in a car or enforcement from a camera, the idea is to change behaviors. We know that red light cameras change behaviors. How do we know this? People that get the first ticket don't get a second ticket. By the time you get to the third ticket, it's like 3%. So we've reduced the number of people that violate electric signals and keep the community safe without seeing an increase in accidents, as the antagonists would say. It allows me now, the police department, to take those resources to solve traffic problems like he just brought to our attention. We can direct resources there, or imagine this. We can go out and actually fight crime and keep the city safe and not focus on traffic tickets.
One of the things that we have talked about a lot in the past, and you've had a chance to observe it in the last year or so, is local control of the police department. Has that made any difference?
Actually, local control to the police department is seamless. I was talking about this as we were dedicating our new building. In the last 18 months, the Metropolitan Police Department has gone through three significant changes. The transition from state to local control, which was almost seamless. There's been no confrontational, no consternation. It just happened on September 1 of last year. We're almost a year into it. Redistricting, which hadn't been done since 1962, and now a new police headquarters. We're going through a lot of change. Some of it is because of local control. We couldn't have redistricted under state control. There was a state statute that said we had to have a number of districts. Moving into the new building, the partnership with the city made it even easier. Local control is good for the police department.
Thoughts, Rick?
No question. Yeah. It just always amazed me that the state continued to operate this police department. The question is, when will Kansas City return to local control?
And they have that option, do they not, under the legislation that was approved? One of the things we talked about last time you were here, Chief, was the concern over the violence amongst young women. And you were going to be taking some action to try to deal with that. Where does that stand presently?
We have a lieutenant, Janet Boskstruck, in the Metropolitan Police Department who handles our juvenile division. She's working with the mayor's task force on juvenile youth violence, along with the juvenile courts, to find new ways and new avenues to direct those young ladies who may see a need to compete with males for criminal enterprises. If you're asking me, could I peg a specific female gang in the city, I can't. What I do know is individual young ladies feel the need to perform at the same level as some young men, and we're trying to offer services, social programs to them.
You were talking about outreach programs and what have you. Since we last talked about this, has the number of incidents involving young women gone down or remained the same or what?
I have not seen an increase in those instances at all. And I'll look to the professor. As we meet every week and talk about crime, we talk about patterns and trends, and isolated, yes, as a continual trend, no.
Right. Rick, any trend out there at the present time you're looking at that has you concerned?
Well, one always has to be concerned about firearm violence. And in the city of St. Louis, I know there are some concerns that as the police department focuses on firearm violence, some residents of the city who live in neighborhoods that don't suffer from a great deal of firearm violence are concerned that about the so-called process of depolicing of their neighborhoods. The police officers who are engaged in hotspot activities in firearm violence hotspots have to come from somewhere. So the concern is, are they leaving my neighborhood, and will I experience more car break-ins, garage burglaries, and the thing that bothers so many people? And the answer is no. I mean, if that were the case, then one would expect a big increase in larcenies in the city. Larcenies in a city like St. Louis very much involve car break-ins. In fact, larcenies are down about 18% year-to-date this year compared to last year. So for those who might be concerned that the hotspot strategy is taking police out of their somewhat more safer neighborhoods with respect to firearm violence, I think the answer is, while there's always more work to be done, crime across the board is down, not simply violent crime.
Chief, a piece in the paper this morning indicating that your sergeants are now going to apparently qualify for overtime pay. Is that going to break the bank?
It'll be a challenge for us. We actually sat down with the sergeants and mediated a solution to the federal lawsuit that was in place that will apply the federal law to our sergeants. It'll be a challenge, and we'll have to manage it, but I think it's the right thing to do.
In the time we have left, which is not much, Chief, I'll come back to you with regard to looking ahead and what's on the drawing board that we should know about.
Well, I think that we've driven so much change in the last 18 mm-hmm. months. I want the department to focus this summer on our core mission, reducing crime, keeping the city safe. And we're going to come back in the fall with some new initiatives. We're going to come around the next generation of hotspot policing. What can we do to partner with the neighborhoods and the communities even more? The neighborhood ownership model is an example, but how can we take that to the next level? Mm-hmm. And we'll be back in the fall.
And what's your role going to be in that, Rick?
One never knows. I will continue to consult with the police department about strategy and evaluate strategies, and also continue my work evaluating the criminal justice system response to firearm violence, particular overall, not just simply the police response.
Yeah. And the chief mentioned neighborhoods. That's a key component, getting the neighborhoods involved.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'll just make my point again. exercise your right to civilian review, quote unquote, by attending those community meetings run in every district of the city.
Final thoughts, Chief? We have 30 seconds.
And I appreciate the neighborhood involvement, but we're just one piece of the criminal justice process. There's corrections, probation, and the courts. And the neighborhoods, community have to be involved at every level.
Yeah. You've been on the job, what now, a year and a half. How are you holding up?
I'm enjoying it a lot. I have a lot more gray hair now than when I started, though.
Well, at least you've got hair. At least you've got hair. Chief Sam Dodson, thanks so much for being with us. Continued good luck to you in the job. Rick Rosenfeld, nice to see you again. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the five amendments to the Missouri Constitution that will be on the August 5th ballot. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.